From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. On this episode, a look at Christians in the Middle East. With all the turmoil in the region, how are these worshipers faring? Then, in jail, should people have to pay for necessities like blankets and toilet paper? And on a lighter note this week, quitting your day job to play professional sports? Sure. But professional fantasy sports? Also, you might have noticed a lot of fall seasonal beers popping up in the liquor store lately. Pumpkin ale in August were on the case, or rather, the six-pack or the growler, plus new music from Franz Ferdinand. All of that and more on this week's podcast, so listen up and enjoy. Now to our cover story in Egypt. The military-backed government there began a crackdown against demonstrators nearly 2 weeks ago, plunging the country into chaos and violence. For days, this was the sound on the streets. Hundreds of people were killed. Things are quieter now. Most of those killed are believed to have been supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and its ousted president, Mohamed Morsi. The government says it's fighting terrorism and that many members of its police and security forces have also been killed. But the violence has also touched one vulnerable minority in Egypt, Christians. That's our cover story today, the uncertain future for Christians in the Middle East. Video posted on YouTube shows the streets of the city of Minya by night. As the camera moves closer, it reveals an orange glow in the sky. Fire. Flames burst from the arched windows of a Coptic church. Young men toss wooden boards and rocks at the facade. Activists and human rights groups say this scene has played out dozens of times around the country. About 10% of Egypt's population is Christian, and the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, an Egyptian human rights group, has documented attacks on at least 45 churches. 8 schools were also attacked, along with 2 charities and at least 1 orphanage.
Burning our churches, killing our brothers and sisters, and looting our stores.
Mina Tabet is an engineer and an activist with the Coptic Christian group, Mispiro Youth Union. We reached him on his cell phone from Cairo.
I have seen the real meaning of hate.
He says, I have seen the real meaning of hate. That hate, Mina Tabet says, has come from the Muslim Brotherhood and extremist Islamic groups. He also blames the government for failing to provide security. Tabet and other Christians are worried.
I feel more safe now. But I have hope, and I think there will be a chance to rebuild.
He hopes, he says, for a chance to rebuild.
And we will not leave our country. We will live here, and we will die here.
We will live here, and we will die here. The experience of Christians in Egypt is not unique to that country, and it has echoes throughout the Middle East. In fact, Christians make up small but significant minorities in several Mideast countries.
For example, the Coptic Christian community in Egypt predates the coming of the Arabs and Islam. Or the Christian community in Iraq goes back to the earliest times of Christianity. And so it's actually, their forms of Christianity are actually much older forms of Christianity than, for example, Protestant religious traditions.
John Esposito is the director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. He says the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the revolutions of the Arab Spring more recently have brought out open sectarian conflict. But Esposito says it's important to see the violence as not just religious, but also political.
For example, historically, when European colonialism came to the Arab world, they were often seen as European Christian powers that came and conquered, bringing their faith, the Christian faith. And so, if you will, the centuries-long Christians that had already been living there were often brushstroked by that association with Christianity. The second thing connected to that is the fact that rulers like Assad, in fact, Bashar al-Assad's father, people like Saddam Hussein and others, used their relationship with these communities. That is, they offered these communities a sense of security not so much really deep religious pluralism. It was politically motivated security in exchange for support or a relationship. And we see that tension today in Syria.
Remind us of what happened to the indigenous Christian population in Iraq after 2003.
The indigenous population, which goes back again to just about the time of the apostles, was a population that lived within Saddam's Iraq and, relatively speaking, had religious freedom, access to education, and lived in relatively good relations and peace with their Muslim neighbors. With the invasion of Iraq and its occupation, and then the growing militancy in that post period between Sunni and Shia militants, Christians got caught in a crossfire. And for many of the militants, their sense is not only that they are anti the other form of, let's say, Islam, but they introduce an ideology which is anti-US, anti-Christian European countries, and anti the Christians within their own countries. And that's when the bombing of churches, the killings, etc., and then the exodus of significant numbers of Iraqi Christians occurred during that period.
Many of the Christians who fled Baghdad and went to the northern part of the country and sometimes fled the northern part of the country for the relative safety of Syria are now under attack again. There's news of attacks on churches and kidnappings of Christian clergy members in Syria, aren't there?
Yes, and that experience, that is, of the influx of Christians from Iraq, has affected Syrian Christians from the time of the uprising in Syria, because Syrian Christians, when they saw the Iraqis coming in, their great fear was that any kind of overthrow of the government, and their great fear is, would mean that they would suffer the same consequences as occurred in Iraq. And indeed, as we've seen more militant groups coming into Syria to fight, they have, in fact, targeted Christians.
John Esposito, you have studied these populations just about as long as anyone in this country. What do you think will happen in the next few years to the Christian population in the Middle East? Is this a minority that's going to diminish and diminish the way that Jews have in many of these places?
I think it will depend on the country. I think that the jury is really out on Iraq. I mean, we've seen significant numbers have fled Iraq. I think that, you know, the same situation is faced by many Christians in Syria. This is a watershed moment in terms of the issue of democracy, rights for all people, regardless of their religion, including the rights of Muslims. When you look at a country like Egypt, the rights of members of the Muslim Brotherhood. For people who are minorities vis-a-vis the powers that be, they face a very tough time.
John Esposito is a professor at Georgetown University. He's also the director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding there and the author of The Future of Islam. John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you do the crime, you do the time. But if you're doing time at Anderson County Jail in Clinton, Tennessee, it may get a bit more expensive. This week, lawmakers in the county passed a resolution that would charge inmates for basic necessities. $9 for pants, $6.26 for a blanket, 29 cents for a roll of toilet paper. Anderson County Mayor Terry Frank says the cost of running her county's jail, which is just north of Knoxville, has skyrocketed. The budget is $3.5 million more today than it was just a decade ago, and the facility itself has expanded since then.
So the pressure has been on to find revenue sources from other areas instead of just going back to the taxpayers.
UCLA law professor Sharon Dulovich says these so-called pay-to-stay policies are common in many jails across the country.
There are actually three different models of pay-to-stay programs. There are charges for individual items, so necessaries in the prison, court costs, transportation, that kind of thing. And then there are also pay-to-stay programs that have sort of three-star, four-star accommodation for people who can afford to pay not to be put in the county jail with everyone else. And then there are counties like Riverside that actually charge every single person who comes into the jail a per diem of $142 a day.
Does it work? Are they actually saving taxpayers any money?
You know, there's a real flaw in the model because the vast majority of people who are incarcerated are indigent. They have no money. So it's very unlikely that counties are going to collect any money from them. I think of this as the blood from a stone problem. You can't get blood from a stone. And there's huge administrative costs involved in trying to get that blood. And I think it's probably sort of a false economy.
So what does happen, Sharon Dolovich, when an inmate cannot afford to pay?
Often nothing. I mean, look, a lot of inmates, when they are released, they already have a long list of money owing. So, you know, pretty much everyone who is convicted of a crime gets assessed fees and court costs. A lot of people, when they're incarcerated, accrue child support. People who are convicted may have to pay restitution to victims. And in most cases, people have no money. And so there's not even a hope of collection. In some counties where people are more enthusiastic about enforcing these orders, you may have people who are called to come to court to explain to the judge why they haven't paid their debts. And in a lot of cases, people don't turn up for these hearings, but a failure to appear at one of these hearings can lead to the issuance of a bench warrant. So people could actually get arrested and incarcerated for failure to turn up at a hearing to explain why they haven't paid, which of course defeats the purpose of trying to save on the cost of incarceration.
Counties are broke. Is it not unreasonable to expect that they would ask basically, citizens, even convicted citizens, to bear some of the cost of their caretaking?
So I think it's a very fair question. I think intuitively it appeals, but I actually think it gets it backwards. We're not incarcerating people for their own benefit. We're incarcerating people for society's benefit. And there are costs, unfortunately, involved with removing people from the community and housing them in institutions that are separate and apart from society. You know, I tend to think of incarceration, even though it seems odd, as a public good. And if we want to have it, like I said, I think we need to pay for it.
Sharon Dolovich is a law professor at UCLA. Sharon Dolovich, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
In Anderson County, which has a population of just over 75,000, Terry Frank says she's struggling to decide whether to approve her county's pay-for-stay program. She's a law and order conservative, she says, but
it sounds good that we're not going to spend a lot of money on people who have violated the law. It makes, you know, the politicians, and I'm one of them, look good. But how much money are we really going to get? Is it really the solution? And isn't there a bigger problem that needs to be addressed?
That bigger problem, she says, is the legacy issue. Even as Americans have thought of themselves as tough on crime in recent decades, the weighty cost of imprisonment is tough on society. If art is the bane of power, then you know where Evan Roth is coming from. He's taken on Google and TSA, projected graffiti using lasers at the high-rises of Hong Kong. He's drawn Justin Bieber's ire by censoring images of him on the internet. Some might call him a prankster, a rabble-rouser, an enfant terrible, but the Michigan-born Evan Roth calls himself a hacker artist, using any medium, digital or physical, to make his mark. His work has been turning a lot of heads in the international art world and on the internet. He's in MoMA's permanent collection, and he has a show opening in Paris this fall. Now he joins us. Welcome, Evan Roth.
Thank you very much.
So, to a lot of people, hackers are online criminals or activists. Tell us about you. What's your philosophy of the entire word?
Sure. And I think that that term means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I think the hacker community that I'm most inspired by is the one that developed this free software movement, things like Linux, like Firefox. They view hacking as something that's a gift-giving culture that has to do with sort of the playful, clever interventions into existing systems. And to them, they would describe the more malicious or black hat hacking as cracking. They'd really make a clear line between the two of these things.
You say that fun makes the politics go down. So could you explain what you mean by that, your approach to your work, your art?
A lot of the work that I'm making is not just aimed at sort of traditional art audiences of curators and institutions and galleries. I am interested in those audiences, but I'm also at the same time interested in the Bored at Work network, or this huge other audience that exists online looking through a browser every day at work. And fun can help these ideas translate into new arenas. I love this idea that you can make politically motivated content that people click on not because of the politics, but just because they want to see, you know, people driving around a fake Google car. And within that, you can sort of hide messages, or you can be very upfront with those messages.
Well, you mentioned the Google car. Let's talk about the Google car. What were you trying to do? This is one of the things that you're most famous for. You've got a faux Google car driving around New York City. What's going on there?
I should start by saying that this is a collaborative project from the Free Art and Technology Lab, which is an organization I co-founded. And we rented a car for 3 days, and then with duct tape and cardboard created a structure on the roof of that car that looked strikingly similar from a distance to the same car that Google drives around when it's recording for its Google Street View.
And so what happened?
I like working in this mode that's very open, so you don't know what's going to happen. And the audience is often part of the piece, and that was an example where that's the case. And we were just, you know, brainstorming simple things we could do that would put Google in an awkward position, like getting lost and asking for directions, like drinking and driving, like...
running over traffic cones. That was good.
Running over traffic cones, hitting bicyclists. So for me, this is a hack, right?
Right.
But for me, the end goal in a lot of these pieces is personal empowerment. And so this idea that misuse can lead to empowerment experiences is something that comes across in a lot of my work.
You have been collected by galleries from Israel to Barcelona to Paris to the Museum of the Moving Image, MoMA. Do you think this art is ephemeral, or do you think it will pass that historical test of art that it endures?
In terms of its importance, I think the answer is without a doubt yes. To me, it's not about the technology, it's about the culture. And I think that the internet has moved beyond being this technological fascination, and now it's something completely different. And I think that looking back 50 or 100 years, yes, I think institutions are going to want to see what artists were doing with this new medium. In terms of whether it's ephemeral or not, I think the internet is constantly changing. It moves very, very quickly. Some of the work I'm doing is playing with that idea of like the impermanence of the web and trying to figure out how to create snapshots of that that can be archived so that we can look back 50 or 100 years from now and see what that was like.
Evan Roth is an American artist and hacker. He joined us from the BBC studios in Paris. Evan Roth, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
A thousand years ago, a Persian poet named Ferdowsi of Tuz obtained a royal commission to put the ancient legends and myths of Iran into a book of verse. He called this epic the Shahnameh, or Epic of the Persian Kings. It took Ferdowsi over 3 decades and is comprised of 60,000 couplets. That's twice the length of the Iliad and Odyssey combined. Author Azar Nafisi, who wrote the memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran, says the importance of this foundational myth epic to Iranians can't really be overstated.
And my father always told me that this country is very ancient, and so it has been invaded and changed so many times. He said, what makes us Iranian, what gives us an identity, is our poetry, and Shahnameh is at the heart of it. He said, if people want to know what Iranian identity is, they have to read Shahnameh.
Now comes a new, entirely English, gloriously illustrated edition of the Shahnameh, with alluring stories of the king's dynasties.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's 4 tragedies, there's 3 beautiful love stories, there is endless battles between nations. This is like, Game of Thrones.
The brain trust behind this new effort is Hamid Rahmanian, a filmmaker and graphic artist who lives in Brooklyn. His 600-page book includes a fresh English translation of the text, framed by Rahmanian's ornate recompositions of Persian miniature paintings, the kinds of small, detailed paintings that were collected by the wealthy in medieval times for private albums. But this Shahnameh edition is like a monk's gilt-edged tome for the digital age, with linked dynastic stories of fabled kings kings, queens, knights, and magical beings. For Hamid Rahmanian, it was a labor of love.
I spent over 10,000 hours in the course of 3.5 years. I literally locked myself in my studio. I detached from the society to make sure if I finish this. And also, you know, you have to understand the way I built this book, I didn't draw anything from scratch.
Hamid Rahmanian scoured websites for Persian and Mughal depictions of court life, some from Shahnameh texts, ranging from the 14th to the 19th centuries. He would then scan, cut, recompose, and retouch the images. Many of his pages have well over 100 elements, especially the riveting battle scenes, in which you can practically hear the whistling arrows of the archers, the neighing of the horses. Others tell of the dreams of the heroes or depict love scenes. First, an image had to appeal to him.
And then based on that, I go find through my books some visual elements, which is not necessarily from Shahnameh. It's from different stories or just sporadic folios. Right. And pick one by one. Sometimes like a head, you see the ear from one place, the face from another place, the headband is from another place, the feather on the that's how it put together to become one human being.
If a character had a face, he'd keep the face, working to stay true to stories. In this new edition, his collaborator and translator from the Persian to the English was Ahmed Sadri, a professor at Lake Forest College. Sadri was persuaded not only by the artwork, but his own childhood memory from Iran when he was 7.
It was a lazy afternoon, and I had strolled out of the family friend's house, and I and my twin brother at that early age, we came across a public reciter of Shahnameh. We called them Naqqal. This tradition of publicly reciting the Shahnameh is still alive in Iran. And this character, this guy, was walking around with a little cane, and he was telling the story of Rostam and Sohrab.
Rostam and Sohrab are the main warrior heroes who come to life in the Shahnameh. Rostam lives for 400 years. Sohrab is his son. But writer Azar Nafisi says it's Rostam's mother who was her childhood heroine, even her role model, a woman called Rudabeh. The story of Rudabeh and her star-crossed lover, Zal, is very like the story of Romeo and Juliet.
And, oh my God, Jackie, there is a scene where, you know, Rudabeh is in her castle from the window, and they have Zal climb up the window to come to her, and they live a night of debauchery together, you know. They drink and they make love and they swear eternal love, and everybody says no, 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 but they finally, going through a lot of trials and tribulations, they get married.
The Shahnameh is seductive and alluring. Many Iranians are even today named for characters in this epic, which is credited with preserving the Persian language. And the boldness of the women, indeed, constitutes the tension Iranians live within even now. But back to the Shahnameh.
Not only Iran has an amazing history of feminism, beginning with 19th century, but look at how Iranian women were portrayed through the mind of a man, actually, 1,000 years ago.
Illustrator Hamid Rahmanian, also born in Iran, wants Westerners to become as familiar with his childhood epic as they are with the Iliad and Odyssey.
The thing is, I look at myself as a vessel to create this book. And the artists in old days also look at themselves as a vessel that the divinity comes within them and then create these pages.
He drew from the inspiration behind the original Persian miniatures, whose popularity reached their peak in the 14th century. The paintings were methodically constructed by teams of court artists who took their work as sacred.
Most of these pages you see in the Shahnameh is actually composed by many artists. Not a single person would make the whole page. One person does the color, one person does the paint drawing, one person does the greeting. That's why most of this painting doesn't have signatures, because the works of many people.
I asked translator Ahmed Sadri to choose a passage to read. He had to rhyme the work, as Ferdowsi did. In the chapter, A Tragedy of Errors, Rostam unwittingly kills his own son in battle, a reverse of the Oedipus story. I asked Sadri to first read Ferdowsi to us in the original Persian.
اگر توند بادی براید زکنج بخو کفکنت نارسید ترنج ستمکار خانیمش اردادگر هنرمند دانیمش عربی هنر.
And here's the English.
The tale of Sohrab brings tears to one's eyes, and a tender heart is enraged at Rostam, who was most reckless and unwise.
Iranians have been reading Shahnameh in good times and bad, using the epic to bind them together in the chaotic political life that is today's Iran. But if the Shahnameh is refreshment and oasis, the hope by these collaborators is that we will all draw from its glorious pages a tale of moral heroes who struggle against their own foibles to do the right thing. These aren't merely fairy tales, but stories of character, passion, and perseverance in sumptuous color and detail. You could read these Shahnameh tales aloud to your own children, or children of all ages, just as many Iranians do, 10 centuries on. This was the scene one night this past week in a townhouse in Falls Church, Virginia. 9 men with their laptops aglow, all huddled around a dining room table ringed with half-empty beer bottles.
Those wide receivers are moving fast.
They, like thousands of others around the country, were engaged in a fantasy football draft.
Scott, you have to take Larry Fitzgerald. You've had Larry Fitzgerald every year we've had this league.
Tis the season for football-starved fans to pretend to manage their own teams, selecting players and tabulating their real-life statistics after every game, and sometimes at the end of the season, receiving a cash reward. Fantasy sports is a huge business, with an estimated 36 million people in the U.S. and Canada picking teams and talking trash. And now we may be at a tipping point. Meet Drew Dinkmeyer.
I'm a 31-year-old former investment analyst turned fantasy sports professional.
That's right, a fantasy sports professional. He left his job for a full-time career playing fantasy sports. Now, before you get any big ideas, Drew Dinkmeyer is among the elite. He's been recognized as an expert for years, so you can stop writing your resignation letter right now. And this guy's not playing the leisurely game that you and your buddies do. Dinkmeyer's involved with a lesser-known form of fantasy sports that requires daily wagers. Most gamers, you know, they just lay down one bet a season, not him.
If you're playing multiple games on a given night of over $500, you could see a scenario where you're making thousands of dollars a week very comfortably. But that, of course, requires the risk tolerance to be able to outlay that capital on a given night. And so after a few years of playing, I started to have income levels that were commensurate with what I was making in the financial world. And it started to become more of a reality and less of a dream.
Dinkmeyer likens what he does to day trading on the stock market.
What you're doing is you're trying to find a company that is trading for less than it's really worth. You're trying to unlock value. So if there's a company out there that's priced at $50 on a given day, and you think that company is really worth $60 or $70, you want to own that company and invest in that company. And that's the same thing daily fantasy players are doing. They're given a list of prices for all the individual players, and they have to figure out which ones are worth more than those actual prices to compile the best team that can put together the most points.
Now, if you're still thinking, this dude's nuts, or just really, really lucky, he's not entirely reliant on his gambling income. He still gets paid to write for fantasy sports websites. He hosts a show on satellite radio. Plus,
I'm fortunate enough to have a wife that does very well in the financial industry as well, so there's a little bit of financial risk taken off the table.
So Drew Dinkmeyer feels he can live out this sports fantasy dream for the long haul.
This is something that allows me to do all the other things that I wanted to do, which was be a very involved father down the road, hopefully. This is something that I imagine doing for the rest of my life, really.
Today is August 25th, but head over to the beer aisle, and it's like jumping 2 months into the future. You'd be forgiven for thinking it was October already. at least Oktoberfest.
Don't be afraid of it. Drink till you're made of it. Drink a bottle of lager beer.
Lavers, Long Trail, New Belgium Pumpkin, Schlafly Pumpkin. Here we have UFO Pumpkin. We've got Shipyard Pumpkin.
To get an idea of the Oktoberfest invasion, we headed out on a shopping trip with Bill DeBon.
I'm a co-editor at DCBeer.com.
We met up with Bill at Divine's, a liquor store here in Washington, D.C.
So Saranac has a whole shelf here with these delightful jack-o'-lantern looking bottles. Great Lakes Oktoberfest, Harpoon Oktoberfest, Narragansett Fest Beer. Sierra Nevada Tumbler. That's got a little bit of smoke to it.
A whole wall of fall beers. Spicy pumpkin ales, nut brown lagers, malty, toasty brews. Perfect for a cool fall evening. But temps have been in the upper 80s here in D.C.
This is a big gripe. As soon as someone sees pumpkin for the first time in a season, and it's, you know, late July, early August, it's, oh my God, you've got to be kidding me. It can't be this time already. Like, I really, you know, you're taking away my summer from me.
So enough with the griping. If they're on the shelf so early, there's got to be a reason, right?
The one thing that the American diet wants is novelty.
And Harry Balzer would know.
I'm vice president of the NPD group, and for the last 35 years, I have watched on a daily basis how Americans eat in this country.
Balzer works for a group that tracks consumer trends. He says Americans crave new foods and beverages, and the changing seasons are a natural opportunity to shake things up, but just a bit.
The funny thing about it, it's never anything that's totally new to us. It's always a new version of the old thing, whether it's a pie that now has three or four different types of things in it, or a donut that's wrapped in a croissant.
Or an ale flavored with pumpkin pie spice, or a lager soured with cranberries.
The most important thing is they all were beer.
So getting your brewery's product out early is really important. You want to catch that novelty factor. And increasingly, says Bill DeBond, it's not enough just to have a pumpkin beer.
But if you can do something like you take your pumpkin beer and you age it in a rum barrel, or, you know, you make a sour beer that has some pumpkin flavors to it. There are ways to flex your creative muscles and give your fans something that maybe they haven't had before from your portfolio.
Brewers, our favorite time of the year is Oktoberfest.
Rich Michaels called us from Saranac Brewery in Utica, New York. How does Saranac distinguish their pumpkin ale?
The recipe for that, the spice blend, is actually from our brewmaster's wife's pumpkin pie.
Now, Michaels has been a professional brewer for over 20 years.
It does seem that each year there's a push to be the first one out, or not to be the last one out at least.
And if it's weird for us as consumers seeing jack-o'-lantern designs on our August brewskis, imagine how Michaels feels. Fall beers can take up to 10 weeks to brew, so?
It's kind of strange. We start brewing pumpkin beer in, you know, June and July.
Michael says they're going to start work on Christmas beers pretty soon. I'm starting to get seasonal whiplash. But back at Divine's in Washington, D.C., I asked manager Eddie Janik.
Are you selling a lot of this Oktoberfest and pumpkin beers?
We are selling a ton of them, yeah.
And sure enough, a steady stream of customers stopped by to ponder over the fall beer selection. Customer Sarah Carruthers showed us her purchase.
I picked up some Schaffelei pumpkin ale.
And not for the first time this season, either.
So I came here, 2 weeks ago and noticed that they had, 10 pumpkin ales, and that's exactly why I came back today, because I finished the other six-pack that I got.
As for the weirdness factor of drinking a pumpkin pie ale when it's 85 degrees and feels like summer, because it still is?
I'm okay with this heat wave being over and getting into the fall, I guess.
So for the rest of you who still think it's a little early to give up those summer shandies, maybe you just need to adjust your thinking a little instead of autumn beers. Back to school beers.
Right. Just for the parents, though, not for the kids.
So to all you beer lovers out there, cheers. And bottoms up.
Hurrah! Up with the sail of it, up with the mail of the glorious, glorious beer.
And it's time now for music.
Take me out!
9 years ago, this song was a huge hit for the Scottish band Franz Ferdinand, and it started a trend. Bands started popping up all over the place, with one foot at Studio 54 and the other one at CBGB's. So, half dance, half post-punk. While most of those bands are fading away, Franz Ferdinand is back after a four-year layoff with an album called Right Thoughts, Right Words, Right Action. Alex Kapranos is the lead singer and guitarist, and he joins us now from our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You know, this is such a fun album. It's just had me dancing as I've been listening to it. And for anybody who's loved your music, you've had this energy from the very beginning. Did you have any kind of a mission statement going into the writing and recording of this album?
Well, you know, I'm really glad to hear that it makes you want to dance, because that's something we've always wanted to do with the band. And I don't know, I just like a record to make you feel uplifted, like the blood runs a little bit faster in your veins.
Your lyrics are always so inventive, and that's true throughout this album, but Right Action is actually one of the more straightforward. You say, come home, practically all is nearly forgiven, right thoughts, right words, right action. Can you tell me just a little bit about the genesis of this one?
Yeah, sure. It came about when one day I was in Brick Lane Market, which is a flea market in London. And quite often in flea markets, you know, you find these estate sales where somebody's belongings are sold off after they die. And there was a collection of postcards. And these postcards were all blank, apart from this one solitary postcard with this message on it. And in the message field, it said those words. He said, come home, practically all is narrowly forgiven.
Wow.
And I loved it. It was so evocative. You thought, who are these people? Who is being forgiven? And I was thinking, like, if that was me, would I really want to go home? Because it seems really welcoming at first, but then you can think, well, practically all, narrowly forgiven. It's actually quite qualified. I'm not sure I really want to go. I really want to go back home. I thought, all right, we need a chorus which is going to answer this, like a response to that kind of a verse. And I'd overheard this other expression, right thoughts, right words, right actions. I thought, that's a great response. It's not an answer, it's a response which you can maybe come up with your own answers for. Right thoughts, right
words, right action. One of the things about your band is that you're as creative verbally as you are musically. And I did think that this song also had, you know, some really great kind of funk guitar throwback sound to it.
What I love about funk guitar and a lot of the bands, you know, I love things like the JBs and Funkadelic, and I guess later like Talking Heads as well. What they would do is they would take a song and remove the chords, and everything was reduced to melody and counter melody, and those melodies were rhythmic melodies, and that's the way I've always approached it. And I think we always see ourselves as a dance band as much as a rock and roll band, and I think that's probably at the core of it. Like, every person in the band is part of the rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another song I just loved on here, Evil Eye, what's the color of the next car? Well, actually, you guys do it a lot better. We'll just listen to a little bit of it here. What's the color of the next car? I just love, yeah, Red, you bastard. I can just be right on the street with you there. This one explodes.
Oh, cool. I'm really glad. Yeah, this one, you see, my dad's Greek, and I would go to Greece a lot when I was a kid, and a lot of Greek culture, I feel, is very much part of my heritage. In Greece, my grandmother was obsessed with the evil eye and people putting the evil eye on you in different ways you would have to ward off the evil eye. And she was also obsessed with predicting the future as well. She would read the grounds of the coffee cup. I would look in and I'd maybe see some squiggles, and with a bit of a push, I could maybe imagine seeing some mountains and rivers, but she would just see death and destruction and calamity. And
but you never go wrong with that.
No, of course not. And I think those kind of superstitions have stuck with me throughout my life. And even though, like, I have these intellectual ideas where I kind of dismiss the majority of religion or whatever, and you think, but I'm still superstitious at heart, and, like, I've still got a soft spot for all that sort of thing. And I was sitting in this cafe and I was like, yeah, maybe I've got the evil eye. Maybe I can predict the future. I was closing my eyes and like, what's the color of the next car? It's going to be red. And I opened my eyes and a red car went past. I went, yes, red, you bastard. And so that's how the song came about.
You You know, your album ends on this ominous note with the lyrics, "Goodbye, lovers and friends. You can laugh as if we're still together, but this really is the end." Gosh, you know, don't scare your fans here. Really? You're not going to break up or anything, are you?
I don't know. I can't predict the future that well. That wasn't the intention. And the song was written completely independently, but we decided it would be, well, you know, when we were deciding on the running order of the album, it's one of my favorite bits, you know, the bit at the end where you've got this collection of songs. It's like making a compilation for somebody. And so the album opens up with the words, "Come home, practically all is nearly forgiven." And it ends with the words, "But this really is the end." And it just seemed like the perfect way to end an album. Maybe not a career, just an album. Anyway.
Alex Kapranos is the lead singer with Franz Ferdinand. Their new album comes out Tuesday. It's called Right Thoughts, Right Words, Right Action. And for a limited time, you can hear the entire album at nprmusic.org. Alex, thanks so much. Congratulations.
Thanks very much, Jackie. Cheers.
For the week ending August the 25th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Catherine Fox, Phil Harrell, Priska Neely, Tom Dreisbach, Liz Baker, Rachel Rood, Elliot Hannon, Sarah Ventry, Andrew Fishman, and Chris Connolly. The technical director is Andy Uther. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, that's the only thing I ask. So don't play pop music. No, you know I hate pop music. Just sing Amazing Godless.